You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Friday, April 22nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, but from the 2016 Mass Torts Conference at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. We'll be talking to plaintiff's attorneys, justices, maybe some media types. We'll see. Maybe David Pakman and I will have a knockdown brawl over regressive leftists. If I pass out for some reason, maybe that will happen. I honestly think I would have to be drunk, David, to do so. And I think this audience knows how that stuff drives me crazy. But we'll see. Stranger things have happened, ladies and gentlemen. Just to give you an update, I have not lost my son's college fund, nor my daughter's college fund, which at this stage in this trip, as it usually goes, is quite an achievement for me. I think I'm up now $25 because I sat down at a game of Casino War, which turns out to be just like war. It's like one step down from Go Fish. And why I sat at that table is a long, long story, which maybe someday I will tell. Just want to remind you of a couple of house cleaning notes. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. You have one more week to use the coupon code MRSPRING16 for 30% off Fair Trade Coffee. Also, don't forget, it is your membership that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Well, let's get right into the show. I mean, folks, one of the reasons why I come down here, in addition to hearing stories of corporate malfeasance, frankly, and one of the reasons is basically to also talk about access to the courts and the integrity of the court system in this country. And on the left, I think we spend far too little time contemplating issues around the Supreme Court, and virtually no time contemplating the implications of courts in general, and particularly state courts. And this is where a huge amount of law is adjudicated, particularly in this era where you have Republicans controlling many state houses around the country. Joining me now is former presiding justice of the Supreme Court of Mississippi, Oliver Diaz. And Oliver, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here today.
Now, this is the first time we've met in person, but I've known your story for years because of that movie, Hot Coffee, And the filmmaker escapes me at the time, but I interviewed her multiple times.
It's Susan Saladoff. She's actually a former plaintiff's attorney as well.
Oh, yes, exactly. All right, so Susan Saladoff, I've interviewed her here and back in the home office, as it were. And Hot Coffee is essentially a debunking of a lot of the myths and lies, frankly, that that undergird the so-called tort reform movement. But one of the stories in there dealt with your time as a justice on the Supreme Court of Mississippi. Tell us your story, because it's been quite an epic one.
Well, sure. First, before I get into the story, I'd like to talk a little about Hot Coffee and Susan Saladoff. When you say Hot Coffee is a documentary about tort reform, I think you may lose a lot of people right there. They're going to go to sleep and say, yeah, I'm never going to watch anything about tort reform, especially a documentary.
Well, not on this audience, but in the main, that could be true.
Exactly. But, wow, I mean, even when Susan first approached me about this idea she had, and Susan's a great trial lawyer, and she's a great experienced litigator, and she had this idea because she had been out there in front of juries telling the story of tort reform, and she would get this feedback from jurors saying, well, you know, I'd like to help you and your clients, but is this one of those crazy cases like when you spill a cup of coffee on yourself and get $1 billion? Are you one of those lawyers who are doing that? And, of course, Susan knew the story behind Hot Coffee, the McDonald's coffee case, the famous case, and wanted to tell a more in-depth story and started doing the process. And she came to me. One of the ideas she had was to talk about judicial elections in this documentary. And when she approached me, she said, I've got this great idea to do a documentary on tort reform. And I'm a practicing attorney and a judge, and I'm very interested in that topic, and I was bored just thinking about a documentary on tort reform. And Susan assured me, she said, that's not going to be the case. This is going to be a great documentary. I've got all these ideas. And she actually put it together, and the film premiered a couple of years ago at Sundance Film Festival to raving reviews. It's won all sorts of awards, and it's because of her insight and her ability to make it not only informational but educational and entertaining. And that's really the best part of the film, is that it's entertaining. She intersplices scenes from like Seinfeld or the Simpsons and just different things to keep the audience entertained. And it's a great documentary. Really quickly about the educational aspect of it, we found out not long ago that the country of Norway, I think it is, one of the Scandinavian countries, I think it's Norway, they actually have made viewing Hot Coffee part of their high school civics classes, so that their students, every student in the country, has to watch it to be educated on the American civil justice system. So that's how great this film has taken off.
Oh, that's a tough way to get introduced to the American justice system, to see some of the assaults on it, I guess.
Exactly. Right.
Well, so let's talk about your story that's told in there, because this is pretty instructive, I think. And for what's going on in the country, in terms particularly of courts that are staffed or by people who are elected.
Exactly. We always hear about in civics classes the three branches of government, you know, the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. Well, for the longest period of time, the judiciary has sort of been the sort of off to the side and sort of like the stepchild of government. You know, everybody is always interested in executive elections, you know, the presidential election going on now, or your local governor's races. So the executive branch gets a lot of attention, and everybody knows their legislators and their congressmen. Those are really exciting races. One of the things that is unique in American jurisprudence is that most of the states in the United States elect their judges in some form or fashion. And for the longest period of time, these judicial elections sort of went unnoticed. They were sort of on the sidelines. And a quick example in Mississippi, my home state, and this is very, very similar to what has happened all across the country. In 1990, a successful Supreme Court judicial election, the candidate who was successful running for the Mississippi Supreme Court spent an average of $25,000 in 1990. When I ran in the year 2000, 10 years later, it was over $1 million. It was closer to $2 million at the time.
Wow.
And so you can see how exponentially from 1990, $25,000 to 2000, 10 years later, it was over $1 million to run.
And now, I mean, do you have a sense of what it would it take to run for that same position?
Oh, yeah. It's an increase from there. Now, a Mississippi Supreme Court race, I think the last one was approaching $3 million. That was a couple of years ago. And we have elections this year in Mississippi. And that's not uncommon. That's the theme going across the country. And what had happened is in these judicial elections, it was actually brilliance on the part of Karl Rove. And I hate to use those words in the same sentence, brilliance and Karl Rove. But he saw that the judicial elections were being neglected. And he really quickly figured out that he could put fairly small amounts of money into judicial races and elect judges who were philosophically aligned with him and his candidates, and they could actually take over the judiciary branch, just like they had the legislative and executive. What they'd found out was that you're electing these conservative Republicans as governor and stocking the legislative branch with young Republican legislators, and they're passing lots of tort reform measures and agendas. But quickly, these measures were being challenged in the courts. And when they got to the court system, judges who were fair and impartial were looking at these and saying, these are unconstitutional. We can't have these sort of laws. It's just not fair to the citizens, and it's denying access to the courts. And so they quickly figured out that in order to keep their tort reform legislation intact, they needed judges who were philosophically aligned hearing these cases who would not rule them unconstitutional. So they began putting this money in judicial elections. And that's what happened in Mississippi in my instance. My election, we were sitting there it was 10 days before the election, turned on the television, and the entire airwave market was flooded by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who came in and dumped over $1 million of negative ads against me right at the last minute. And that's what they've been doing all across the United States.
And so give me a sense of how much money. So you had to raise $1 million in your campaign.
Yes.
And your opponent apparently, had raised a similar amount. So 10 days out, another million comes in. And what was the stakes for the Chamber of Commerce? I mean, was there particular stakes in this race for them?
Every year, the Chamber of Commerce, United States Chamber of Commerce, puts out a list they call judicial hellholes. And Mississippi was always one of the top states at the top of their list of states they thought were unfair to businesses and states where they wanted to target judges. This whole effort started with Rove and Bush in Texas. They captured the Texas Supreme Court fairly quickly, and they thought, maybe we're onto something. We're going to try to export this model that we've made here in Texas and see what we can do in other states. And then they branched out into Alabama, and it worked in Alabama. And after that, they decided to go widespread with it. And in 2000, when I was running for election, they came in with large amounts of money in Mississippi, in Ohio, in Illinois, and several other states. And they quickly realized that by dumping large amounts of money in these extremely negative ads right at the last minute, they were able to influence the election.
Because these are not the type of races where voters are like, I've spent a long time studying the judicial record of Oliver Diaz versus Jim Stevenson. People go in and they just pull a lever,
right?
And if there's the slightest bit, I mean, so there's multiple factors here. One is that it is it's an election that nobody has really. I mean, for the most part, your average voter has very few cues in which to go off of.
Right.
Two, the implications of money goes a lot longer, bigger in that respect, because it's not as much money involved. And then three, unlike a politician who then, if they get in office, can't really unilaterally or even can't unilaterally do most things. I mean,
right.
A governor can sign. When you're talking, you're one of five or six or seven justices. You have a tremendous amount of power,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah. And also you've got the judicial canons that keep us from speaking out on issues. So we're not, even when we do make a decision, we're not allowed to publicly justify or explain or promote or anything. Our decisions are in writing, and let's be frank, most people don't read judicial opinions for the fun of it. As a judge, we get this feeling that, yeah, we are very well known in the community, and we're very popular. You know, we sit at the bench, and when we walk in the room, lawyers stand up, and you know, people refer to us as Your Honor and Yes Sir and that sort of thing. And it, you sort of get this feeling that, you know, you're fairly well known in the community. But, you know, that's the furthest thing from the truth. You always see these crazy surveys every year or so. You can see somebody will do something. More people can name the Three Stooges than three members of the United States Supreme Court. That's just America. And so people don't know who judges are. And therefore, when you dump a large amount of money, not only are you getting involved in a race that normally doesn't have a large amount of money, but you're in a race where a little bit of name recognition can tremendously influence the outcome of an election, and that's what happens.
Okay, so you get this money is dumped in 10 days before the race. What is your what do you do, and what happens after what you or what are the implications?
Yeah, you've got to imagine being in the heat of an election, and you're 10 days out of the election. Practically all of your money is raised and spent at that point. I actually had in my race the media guy that I had running my media for the campaign actually came to me and said, you know, these are the media buys we've made. These are the media buys your opponent has made. And based upon what we've got booked and no more can be booked after today, it looks like, you know, the polls show you in the lead, and he doesn't have enough money to really overcome your name recognition. It looks like it's going to be a fairly good race for you, and that's 10 days out. And then all of a sudden, this independent third party, the United States Chamber of Commerce, and they advertised in their name. They quit doing that now. They don't advertise. They usually come up with some AstroTurf group name, like Citizens for a Better Ohio or something generic like that. But when they ran against me, it was the United States Chamber of Commerce paid for by at the bottom. But the thing is, they don't have to disclose who their donors are. Nobody knows where their money comes from. And so they dumped all of this money in, and we had to scramble at the last minute in order to counter these terrible negative ads. And what they do, they don't look at judicial decisions and talk about the civil justice system, which is what they're interested in. They don't talk about civil justice cases. They will run ads saying that in a criminal case, I may have voted to allow a drug dealer out of prison.
Right.
And you know, that's what a judge does on appeal. If there's errors in the trial, we vote to overturn an opinion. And of course, as you mentioned before, I am one of five votes, which is a majority on the court, nine judges total, but five votes can carry a majority. So they use these really wild criminal decisions. They really focus on those in order to inflame some sort of passion and get folks really having a negative concept of that judge in their mind, and that's how they do it.
And so you went out. I mean, and then what did you do in response?
So when that happened, I had to go out and scramble to raise enough money to sort of counter these negative ads at that point. And there's not enough time to throw together fundraisers and call on the phone and start thing. So what happened in my case, we had to go and actually take out loans from the bank. And if you know anything about banking, banks don't like to loan money to campaigns because they're not very stable and they may not get
this
their money
not
back.
Like investing in a business.
Exactly.
Right.
And they want some sort of guarantee. So I had to get some of my friends to guarantee these loans at the bank, saying that we're going to pay these back after. And so that's what we had to do. We had to scramble and at the last minute came up with a little over $100,000 in order to combat these negative ads. And I went to some of my friends, Dickie Scruggs, Paul Miner, who were lawyers on the coast at the time. They co-signed loans with my campaign, assuring the banks that these would be paid back.
So, unsurprising, your friends who are willing to do this at the last minute are attorneys. But ultimately, this becomes a way of essentially getting you off the bench and getting you charged.
Exactly. So what had happened was I was not defeated. I was ultimately successful in my election. We were able to combat these negative ads. I stayed on the bench, won the election, and What had happened was the U.S. attorney then, who was a Republican appointee, he actually ran for Congress as a Republican in the same election in 2000 where I was running. He was defeated, but George W. Bush appointed him as U.S. attorney immediately after the 2000 election. Right after that election, he began looking at my race in particular and said that me getting attorneys to co-sign these loans for my campaign was actually a form of bribery. And I was indicted ultimately for bribery because he had he'd used that. The catch to the whole thing, though, is that these guys were my friends, and because they had been so influential in my election, I actually refused to vote in any of their cases that came before me on the court.
That so you had recused yourself of these cases prior to the indictment or the charges?
Prior to the indictment and the charges. I actually talked to the attorneys and I said, you know, you're heavily involved in my campaign. If I'm elected, I'm not going to vote on your cases. I'm not going to sit in your cases. And they were fine with that. I was fine with that. But the U.S. attorney still looked at that and said that that was a form of bribery and indicted us nonetheless.
Were there any cases that came up after you were after you sat as a justice that involved those lawyers?
There was. Ultimately, myself and Paul Miner, who was a plaintiff's lawyer in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast, were indicted because of this. And actually two other trial court judges that Paul Miner had basically done the same thing with in their trial court races. And so there were about five or six cases that Paul Miner or his firm had at the Supreme Court where I was sitting, and I had recused on every single one of those when they came up to the court.
And I think people remember, I mean, this was that class, if you will, of U.S. attorneys was renowned for having been very highly politicized. This is
yes.
Like the Chris Christie class.
Exactly.
And
this was this class of U.S. attorneys who ultimately, a group of them resigned in mass because they called the White House and said that you were actually forcing us to make political decisions on criminal prosecutions.
So what is the fix for this ultimately?
Yeah, well, you know,
because I mean, it seems to me, right, that the value that the Chamber of Commerce offered for your opponent, not fundamentally different than the value your friends offered for you in terms of guaranteeing a loan, theoretically, any member of the Chamber of Commerce, any paid member, subscriber, should not be able to have a case in front of the court without the justices recusing themselves if they've been if they have benefited from advertising, right? I mean,
you would think that would be the quid pro quo, but no, it's not, and it's only gotten worse in recent years.
So what's the solution to this?
Yeah, with Citizens United decision, it's gotten worse because there's more money and there are more players coming in even in judicial election. The solution, I mean, there's several solutions we need to look at. I mean, we need to look maybe public financing of judges. Maybe we need to look at appointed judges like the federal judiciary. I was actually appointed and I was elected, so I'm familiar with both systems. There's politics involved in both.
Right.
The difference, I think, in appointed judges is that the person, even if you're philosophically opposed, if you're a Democrat and the executive is the decision maker is a Republican. The difference, I think, is that the person who is making an appointment generally wants to appoint someone competent to those positions. Even if they're philosophically opposed to you or aligned with the person making the appointment, they generally want to appoint somebody that's competent. When you've got wide open elections, that's not necessarily the case. Anybody
right.
can get in, and they have.
Wow. All right. Well, Oliver Diaz, thanks so much for your time today. Fascinating story. People can find Just Coffee, I would imagine.
Hot Coffee. It's streaming coffee. On Netflix, Amazon, Xbox, any of the streaming services. Look for it. Hot Coffee. It's a great documentary. It's fun to watch.
Thank you. Just Coffee, of course, you can find at justcoffee.coop. And if you use the coupon code MRSPRING16, you get 30% off. But Hot Coffee. Hot Coffee, you watch. Thank you, Oliver Diaz. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're just going to take a quick musical interlude, and then we will be back with more. Coming up next, we're going to hear a story of a massive recall of airbags, the kind that are in your car. We'll be right back after this. So, Michael, I Am the John Grisham books are real. In fact, Oliver Diaz, who was just with us, was the inspiration for the novel The Appeal, John Grisham's The Appeal. And next week, oddly enough, speaking of John Grisham, didn't John Grisham write 1L? I think he wrote that book one. No, maybe that was Scott Turow. Well, next week, as I think I've teased, I accidentally interviewed one of my law professors from 25 years ago in the 1 year I went to law school. And but the other professor I had was the model for Scott Turow's 1L, the John Houseman character. And I can't even remember the name of that show now. It doesn't matter. Ladies and gentlemen, joining me now is Rich Newsom. He is an attorney from Orlando, from the firm Newsom Melton. Rich, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Okay, you got to go right into the microphone here.
Oh,
right.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here. How's that?
That's great. Now, Takata? Is that what? Am I pronouncing
yep,
it?
Yep, you are. Absolutely.
Okay. Tell us about this this case, because I've read about it. It seems massive.
You know, it's funny. You were talking about the John Grisham and the Turow novels. I'm predicting right now that one of these guys is going to pick up on this Takata epic saga, because that's what it is. The story about this is when you really hear the whole thing, it's just unbelievable. My first call or exposure happened about a year and a half ago when I got a call from a friend of mine who was a neighbor, who was a doctor, and said, "Hey, you do airbag litigation, right?" And I said, "Yeah." So I got a guy in my office. I just pulled a 3-inch shard of steel out of his eye, and I think it's from the airbag. I'm like, "Let me guess. This is a Honda vehicle, right?" He's like, "Yeah, how'd you know?" So there'd be this sleeping story that began back in 2005 or so, where there was a sort of a silent little recall. There were certain Honda vehicles that were having airbags go off. And instead of protecting the occupant, the inflator, which is a little piece of steel casing that houses an explosive, would shatter, sending metal into people. And
wait a second. So how is... Well, all right, let's back up for a moment here. How is this airbag supposed to work?
Okay, good question.
Because, I know it's there.
Right.
And I just assume it's... works in a way that helps you.
Right, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, airbags are great technology. They save hundreds of thousands of lives. And the way they're supposed to work is that when you're in a frontal crash, you know, and you're not low-speed fender benders and not high-speed crazy crashes where nothing's going to save your life, but moderate to moderately severe crashes, you're in an impact, the airbag sensors detect a crash that causes an explosive, basically it's a little bomb behind your steering wheel to go off. sends gas into this bag and miraculously saves your life by providing a cushion. Now, it's explosive technology, but it really, really does work. Well, the problem with these Takatas is the explosive device is about the size of a hockey puck, and it contains an explosive material. And in the Takata bags, it's called ammonium nitrate. Now, ammonium nitrate is the same kind of explosive that Timothy McVeigh used, for example, to blow up the federal courthouse years ago. So it's really volatile stuff, and it's fine when it works. But unfortunately, as some of the engineers said early on, before these things went into production, hey, ammonium nitrate can be really unstable, and it's really kind of dangerous if it's exposed to heat and humidity. But lo and behold, the decision was made to cut dollars, save money, and use ammonium nitrate anyway.
And so when you get that call from your neighbor who says, I had a patient with a metal shard, where's the metal coming from, the container of the explosion?
That's exactly right. So it's the little hockey puck steel device that contains the explosive. And what happens is over time, especially in hot, humid states like Florida, Florida's actually ground zero for most of these cases because of the humidity. Over time, it doesn't happen when the thing's 6 months old, a year, 2 years. It's only when you're getting into the 4, 5, 6-year-old vehicles that over the time that heat and humidity starts to cause that ammonium nitrate to become unstable. And it ends up exploding with too much force, which ends up blowing up that little steel device and sends it, of course, into the occupant space, which is potentially deadly.
So what was supposed to happen with that device? It's that that the explosion happens away from the device and the device doesn't? I mean, I don't understand, like, why
right.
would you encase the explosive material in steel?
Good question.
I mean,
yeah, so
because
so
you're just, that's like you're designing it for shrapnel.
No. Actually, it's designed the way it's supposed to work. There are little tiny holes around the outside. Think of the hockey puck. And around the edge of the hockey puck, there are little pinholes. They're a little bit bigger than pinholes, but just for, you know, easy description. And when the explosive, the device explodes, sensor tells, remember those little model rockets when we were kids, Estes model rockets? Did you ever shoot those off?
Yes.
The solid fuel little engine that we used?
Uh-huh.
That's the same kind of concept. So you put solid fuel, basically, inside of this little steel hockey puck, and when it explodes, just like the model rocket, it's supposed to go through the little holes on the side of the hockey puck, filling up the airbag with gas. And it happens really fast, because if it doesn't happen fast, you're not going to give protection in time
right.
for a crash. It happens all in milliseconds, by the way. And it's really great when it works. But if it explodes with too much force,
I see.
Then all of a sudden, instead of coming out the little holes, it blows the little canister up and sends shrapnel into the occupant space.
Okay, now I understand. So it's the size of the explosion is supposed to be small enough that you'll get the basically the gas of the air
that's
that
exactly
will seep
right.
out.
You want but the good gas and not the metal.
So why did they use this material as opposed to, are there other materials, let's say, that are used in other airbags?
Absolutely. Yep. And that's what these early engineers had said. And now we know this from some of the documents which have finally become public. And so the whole public story where we are today, and by the way, we have now the largest recall in automotive history. Largest recall in automotive history. There's already 26 million that have been recalled, and I believe that I've heard estimates from one of our United States senators who's been very involved in this that it may be upwards of 120 million vehicles internationally before it's over. This is not over. This story continues.
Okay, so wait a second. So what other materials are used in other airbags?
Oh gosh, I mean there's several that can be used. I mean, but ammonium nitrate's the bad stuff, and frankly that's what's happening now. There are backing up on the story. When they were originally replacing these, pursuant to what was called a technical service bulletin, which is kind of like what I call a secret recall.
Okay, so when did this secret recall happen?
Okay, like, so here's the
story. Me the timeline of how the company came to understand this. And we should also say this is a third party that sells the airbags to what makes of cars?
11 different automobile manufacturers.
11 different manufacturers.
That's right. That's exactly right. So
how many different automobile manufacturers are there that sell cars in the United States?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's 11 of the big ones, I can tell you that. I don't have the list off the top of my head, but, you know, Ford, Chrysler, General Motors, Toyota, Honda, Lexus. I mean, you go down the list, BMW. Most of, you know, Takata was one of the two biggest airbag manufacturers in the world, and they've done a good job with some of their products. But when they made this decision around the 2002 timeframe to put these in, it was against the advice of some of their engineers who, and this is what's great. I mean, this is an example of how journalism can really lead to safety. There was a series of articles that the New York Times did by one of their reporters who was based in Japan. I think her name is Hiroko. I can't remember her last name. Anyway, phenomenal investigative reporting. She found some whistleblowers who said, hey, look, we told them not to use this stuff.
When was this reporting?
Oh, gosh, this all happened within the last 2 years.
Yes,
this is
okay.
When it all
right.
broke loose. So there was a confluence of things. So going back to 2002, there was some testing in 2004, 2005 that's now come out that was reported in the Times they found that there was a problem with this. And now we know from the documents they knew there was a problem.
Did they know there was a problem? So did they start doing the testing in 2004 for devices that they put in cars starting in 2002?
You know, I don't remember off the top of my head when the testing was done, what was done. But what we now know is that they knew that there was a problem. Some of the engineers were saying, hey, look, this stuff can become dangerous. It can become unstable. And they knew it during the early 2000-ish, 2004, 2005 timeframe. So fast forward, now incidences start to happen. And most of the Takata bad airbags were in Honda vehicles. And so they started to happen. People started to get hurt, and they were settled quietly and secretly. It never bubbled up. And there's a great consumer safety advocate named Sean Kane who started talking about this on his blog, on his safety blog. And, I think I heard about this from Sean in the 2012, 2013 timeframe.
Wow.
That, hey, look, these things are happening. There's a problem with these airbags. They're blown up. But it was all under the radar. And unfortunately, the dirty little secret in automotive safety is that recalls happen all the time. Secret recalls, technical service bulletins. But the public usually never hears about it until it hits a critical mass of media attention.
And so where does this stand now? I mean, have they had to recall all of these? Or have they recalled just the ones that they've had to recall?
I think you've said it very well. So Bill Nelson, Florida's United States Senator, got really upset about this. There was a death. There was the Corey Burdick case that we were involved with from the one I told you about where my neighbor called me. And it was starting to, and he met these clients. And he started looking and said, I'm going to hold Senate hearings. And he held Senate hearings where he called Takata and Honda and some other manufacturers before the U.S. Commerce Committee back in, I think it was October of 2014. I think, 2014. Anyway, and all heck broke loose. Class actions were filed. The public finally became aware of the problem, and lots of cases started to become filed. And it was only as a result of that public media attention that the recall happened, but it's been rolling. It's been growing, as you've seen in some of the newspaper reports. Heck, I think just 2 weeks ago, it was expanded again.
So from Takata's perspective, that is most cost-efficient to slow walk this recall, right? Because if they have to replace all of these things tomorrow, that's sort of an overwhelming expense.
Well, it's impossible. It's
right.
Physically impossible. I don't remember the numbers, but if you've got 26 million vehicles that need new airbags, you just don't have the physical plant to accomplish that.
Right.
You can't do it.
Right.
Not quickly anyway. So I don't know what Takata thinks or why, but that's just a real big problem. Not just from a cost perspective, but just from a physical impossibility.
So what happens if it becomes clear? I mean, where is the United States government on this? I mean, isn't there at one point they say hey, this should be a mandatory recall, and you've got to replace them all tomorrow.
Well, NHTSA has been very involved. So NHTSA stands for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. That's the federal agency that regulates the automobile and tire industry. And fortunately, the NHTSA has been very much on top of this ever since this became public. Poor NHTSA. They don't have enough dollars.
Right.
They are understaffed. They are under-resourced. They're doing most of the time the best that they can do, and this has just simply overwhelmed them. And so it's been a combination of good congressional leadership, frankly, by Senator Bill Nelson and the NHTSA that they've been trying to get a hold of. I mean, part of the problem with this was just getting their arms around the documents and the story. I mean, it's not like Takata came up and said, okay, here's what we have, here's all of our documents. This has been a process of teasing out information that
How much of the documents came out in discovery on some of these?
Oh, my
cases?
Goodness. I think the initial discovery, or not initial discovery, the initial disclosure from Takata to NHTSA was, I think, 1.2 million documents.
And
that's not the end. I mean, it's continued since there.
And these documents, I mean, the ones that are, most relevant to getting Takata to either pay for or replace or a mandatory recall are ones which show that they had knowledge of this potential failure of
their
product.
That's exactly correct.
And so what is it? What's the next step here? Is it just like we're going to hear more and more? I mean, should anybody out there? Is there any way for, like, the consumer right now, somebody who's listening, to go and say, check their and find out what brand of airbag they have in their car and whether or not this is one where it is this ammonium nitrate as opposed to some other type of
Right. Safer airbag.
Yeah.
It's a mess.
How can people check?
Well, there's not a real clear. That's why I tell you, this is going to be a John Grisham novel at some point, right? I mean, there's going to be movies about this. There's not a really good answer. The best answer, though, right now, as we sit here today, is for consumers to go to the NHTSA website, which is safercars.gov. And there's something called a VIN number that every vehicle has. It's a unique identification number that a car has, stands for Vehicle Identification Number. And if you look on your dashboard, right above, sort of behind the steering wheel, there's a little metal plate that's attached. And it's a multi-digit, probably 11 different numbers. And write that down on a piece of paper. And then go to safercars.gov, and there's a place where you can put that in. It'll take you 5 minutes. And the cool thing about the NHTSA, and the NHTSA website has gotten much, much better over the last few years, largely in response to this and some of the other recent recalls that we've seen in the last 2 years. So NHTSA's getting better, the website's getting better, and you can plug in that VIN number in the NHTSA website to see if your vehicle has been recalled for an airbag or, frankly, anything else.
And then what do you do? I mean, if you see that it's been recalled, but you can't even tell necessarily if it's one that's going to be recalled
in the future.
In the future,
right.
Because they just haven't gotten around to it.
That's correct, right.
Like, now, in the event that there is a recall, what do? You contact your dealer?
So one of the other things that's happened as a result of this, which is great, and it's been a combination of, like I said, the investigative journalism, Bill Nelson focusing with the Senate Commerce Committee, the litigation, the media, which has been on this. The other thing that's gotten better is recall notification. So in the past, like, for example, with this and other recalls, you know, you maybe get a postcard. The postcard doesn't really tell you that much. So now if the recall's expanded and you get, as a consumer, something in your mailbox that says, pay attention to it. Don't throw it out. Don't assume it's a piece of junk mail. So that's my number one advice. Number two is, of course, or actually number one is go to the website, check your VIN. Number two, pay attention to those notices when they come in, and then take your car into the dealership immediately. And if you're a family that only has that one vehicle, ask them to give you a rental car, because they will. Honda, I don't advertise this, but this is kind of like Rich's free tip of the day. If it's a Honda, for example, go in and say, I want a rental car. We've had clients who've done that, for example, before, and they say, wait, so you want a rental car? Yes, I want a rental. And they've told Congress they'll do it, and so they will give you a rental car until it's fixed.
Now, one last question. Is there a way to know if your vehicle is one of those that will be recalled?
Oh, boy.
I mean, I'm not saying just broadly speaking,
right.
But I'm saying specifically for this. Because
no, there's not. And that's the weird thing, and that's the sad thing in this, and that consumers are really the ones who are squeezed between a rock and a hard
because
place.
Because Takata, like we say, they can't go into production and all of a sudden build 26 million new airbags.
That's right.
They need to have this drip drab out.
Mm-hmm.
So
part of the problem has been grappling with why did this happen? You know, is it because if ammonium nitrate is properly sealed, properly contained, properly produced, everything's perfect, it can work. I mean, the vast majority of these airbags don't explode, right? It's only when there are problems, and unfortunately, these were foreseeable problems. And so I think that That's something Congress, the NHTSA,
and
the
money, right? I mean, isn't it just because they wanted to save money or they had a cheaper production?
Bingo.
I mean,
that's it. That was the problem.
That's always the answer.
That's it. Yeah, follow the money, right?
Well, Richard Newsom from Newsom Melton, thank you so much for your time today. Really disturbing story, but people should head to that. We will put that in it's NHTSA. We will put a link to NHTSA at majority.fm. Michael, if you're back in New York listening to the sound of my voice.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for all you guys do. You guys are great consumer advocates, and we appreciate all your work.
Thank you, Richard. Michael, I presume that you are listening to the show right now. I know that Friday is yoga day. When you, Michael has already linked it to the blog. Apparently, he has connectivity in his yoga spa. All right, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm going to play now is a brief clip of an interview I did yesterday, I guess, in the afternoon. Ultimately, I'm going to play this, but it's a 40-minute interview. And it's really focused primarily on the implications of Antonin Scalia and of his death in terms of where we're going to see differences, specifically in plaintiff's law and access to the courts. It's a fascinating interview with Arthur Bryant from Public Justice. This is sort of the public option of trial lawyers. They take cases that are too risky for private attorneys to take. So these are ones that fall through the cracks, basically, because it's extremely expensive to pursue cases, and particularly if they are sort of on the one edge of a leading edge of the development of tort law, this public justice does it. But this is just a clip from Arthur Bryant. It is a pretty disturbing story of one of the things I had just asked him was in the course of discovery. Discovery is the segment of the pretrial where the party involved, the defendant, must hand over all the documents surrounding the specific controversy. It's requested by the the plaintiff's attorney. And so I asked him, what was the most sort of disturbing document you've seen? Because I'm coming to realize, as I've been here for a couple of years now, there's always, each of these lawyers have one of those. They tend to have like two or three, frankly, of what they find to be disturbing documents that certain cases turn on. And so I asked this of Arthur Bryant, and it's just a 3-minute clip, but it's pretty amazing. What's the single most disturbing document you've read in discovery?
I would say the most disturbing document I can recall, and maybe it's because I only recently saw it, is from Remington Arms. The single most popular rifle in the country is the Remington 700. There are 7.5 million of these rifles out there. It's been sold since, for decades. It has a defect in it. It will sometimes shoot when no one pulls the trigger. And wrap your mind around that. We learned about this from a man named Rich Barber, who was an expert marksman in Montana who took his wife and son out and kids, I'm sorry, wife and kids out on a hunting trip. They come back, the wife is emptying the rifle. She takes the safety off because you have to do that to empty the rifle. Her finger's nowhere near the trigger. The gun shoots, and kills their 9-year-old boy. Imagine. And the document, and Remington denied there was anything wrong with the gun. To this day, denies there's anything wrong with the gun. And we, Public Justice, just succeeded unsealing every document in every Remington rifle case ever filed. And so within the past month, I have seen a document showing Remington, and I would say Remington said the entire time that we can't get these to fire when we do the tests. The experts we hire can't do the tests, so it must be the owners are doing something wrong with these guns. So that's the problem. There's no defect here. And the document I saw showed they had been able to get it to fire when they did the tests.
Jesus.
They had been able to repeatedly to get it to fire when they did the tests over decades, and for decades they were lying to the public. They were settling cases and then sealing all the records in them. So year after year, people were being shot or killed or maimed or injured because of this defect. And Remington knew the whole time and went into court and lied about it in court and went into the public arena and lied about it and is still lying and saying, these guns are not defective and the tests we've done don't say it when I know and they know it's not true.
Wow. And how does those documents get publicized? Are we going to be reading about those soon?
Well, we brought them to CNBC, which did a one-hour special, Remington Under Fire. Actually, when we first unsealed some of those documents 5 years ago, they did that. And now we got all the rest unsealed, including the ones I just mentioned. So they did a second follow-up called Remington Under Fire, The Reckoning, which showed, they did make it happen when they did the test themselves. So the documents, anybody can get them on the web. Just go on the web right now, go and look up Remington Under Fire. But also Public Justice is creating a website where we're going to post all of these documents.
Wow.
So the public can have access to them.
That's fantastic. So that was just the clip from that interview with Arthur Bryant from Public Justice, and we'll play that sometime in the future. It's a longer interview, and I knew I wouldn't have time for it today. But I mean, it's the nature of the stories that you hear around here. It is really the only thing I can sort of like compare it to on some level is just. My father's a bankruptcy attorney, or doesn't practice as much bankruptcy as he used to. But I just remember as a kid, all of just hanging out with my dad. If we were at any type of public venue, and he would just be like, "Oh, there's Bill Stevenson. Yeah, Chapter 11. It's rough." And that's the only. You hear these conversations between lawyers where they just go like, "Oh, we found this document. These people are disgusting." I mean, there are some lawyers here who just. It's sort of like also like I've talked to New York City cops who are just like, "Don't ever let your kids near the subway, you know, till it comes to a complete stop. Always keep them very close to the wall," because some stuff I've seen in my 25 years as a cop has been really disturbing. And there's that quality here, too, where people are just walking around going like, "Oh, my God, I'm working on this case about this medical device, and you can't believe what they knew." And that Remington one is amazing. And that's, you know, that is a case about a defective product, distinct from the special immunity that gun manufacturers have for an effective product. Joining and All right, I want to play one more interview. This is one, actually, that I recorded yesterday afternoon, and then we'll head into the fun half. This one involves... there's a little bit of public policy here, and just another example of an impressive use of the resources. I mean, these attorneys here, they do all sorts of cases, obviously. This one is coming out of Indiana. it involves Mike Pence. And, you know, we hear these stories sort of broadly speaking about Republican governors who, whether it's in New Jersey, whether it's in Kansas, really just about any state with a Republican legislature and governor, where they are attempting to cut taxes and cut services. And usually those services that are cut fall on the least powerful political constituencies. And fortunately, in this story in Indiana, a law firm stepped in at one point. This is Lynn Toopes. And here's that interview I recorded yesterday. Joining me now, Lynn Toopes, an attorney with Cohen and Malad. And are you based in Indiana?
Yeah, in Indianapolis.
And so... this is a case of, well, why don't you tell us what this case involves?
Sure. So up until 2014, Indiana was the only state in the nation that did not pay an adoption subsidy to families that adopted special needs children out of the foster care system. And basically, an adoption subsidy is a daily subsidy, ranges from $17 to $25 a day, that helps these families to raise these children, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford to adopt the child because they require a lot of care. So Indiana was the only nation that didn't pay this subsidy. But Indiana.
Why, now, why is that? I mean, just that's a pretty unique distinction.
It's you know, honestly, I think it was just to save money. But again, you know, what our study showed in the case was that it ends up costing the state more money when you don't pay an adoption subsidy, because then the children don't get adopted and they age out of foster care, end up back in the system, you know, whether through jail or whatever, which ends up costing the state a lot of money. So to just pay this small amount of $17 to $25 a day until the child turned 18, although it seemed like a lot of money, you know, it was in the tens of millions of dollars, it ended up saving the state a lot of money on the back end. But I think
Do you have a sense of how many kids we're talking about?
It was 1,800. It was over 1,800 children, because up until 2009, we did pay this, but Indiana stopped paying it in 2009 because we put a cap on property taxes. So there was it was paid by counties, so counties were financially burdened because they no longer were going to have the sort of property tax income that they were previously having. So there needed to be cuts, and apparently this was under Mitch Daniels, our former governor Mitch Daniels. This cut was made.
Former budget director, do I have that right, Mitch Daniels? Well, the point being that they come in, they want to cap property taxes. They don't allow any municipality. Is this state property taxes, or these are like local property taxes?
This is like local property taxes that would go to the county. And so the state said, well, if we're going to hurt the counties like this because they're not going to be getting the money in that they're used to getting, we'll take over some things. One of the things we're going to take over is this adoption subsidy program. Took it over and then cut it.
And so they cut the subsidies to provide for the adoption of these kids. And then what happened?
So then what happened was the families kind of needed to be still induced into adopting these children because it was so financially burdensome. An interesting statistic is that over half of the families that adopt children out of special needs, they almost live in poverty themselves. It's not wealthy people that adopt these children. So anyway, what happened was Indiana came up with this one page kind of, or actually it was like two or three page contract, right? And where, you know, it said, they would write in a number anywhere from $17 to $18 and say, we'll pay you this adoption subsidy. You know, this is happening in the courthouse and they're getting ready to adopt this child. They sit them down. We'll pay you $17, $18, $25 per day. But it says if funds are available, sign it, families adopt the child, and then that's when they're told, well, actually, there aren't funds available. Because what was happening was, in Indiana, we're operating under a budget surplus, right? So what the governor does is he gives a state agency, you know, $100 million, but that agency is told 25% of that has to come back at the end of the year. So they don't really get $100 million at all. They're only allowed to have the $75 million, but then they give back $25 million at the end of the year. So it looks like, great, you know, we've got all this extra money. We've got this huge surplus. We're such a financially healthy state. But obviously to do that, a lot of cuts have to be made. And unfortunately in Indiana, it was made off the backs of these special needs children. So they said they didn't have funds available because they really only had, you know, $75 million, for example, was not the right number, but they only had a certain amount of money allocated and then they had to give the rest back. Well, we said, we came up with this argument that no, that money was available.
All right, let me just back up here. So on the day that they do these adoption proceedings, they're signing these documents, or is this was this promise to ultimately pay in the event that there is money? Was that something that went into the process of folks deciding whether or not they could actually?
Yeah, that's what these families were told.
So
us.
This wasn't a surprise on the day that this IOU, more or less, wasn't presented to them. For the first time, or at least the concept of it, wasn't
right. They did not understand. I mean, and again, it didn't matter for the lawsuit whether they understood or not. I mean, we were dealing with black and white, you know, contract language. But basically, the families, it was all over the map what they were told and what they were understood, you know, what they understood they'd be receiving. But by and large, they thought that either the funding was available or would be available. They didn't understand that it would never be available and they would never receive any money. There was actually called the state adoption subsidy waiting list. They were on the understanding that they were on a list, and as funds became available, they'd be coming off the list and be paid. But nobody was getting taken off the list.
And just again, to clarify, as people are making the decision as to whether or not they can sustain adopting these children, they're doing it with at least the understanding that ultimately we're going to get $15 to $25
right.
per day.
And if those families were fostering these children prior to the adoption, which they frequently were, they are getting a foster subsidy of about the same amount. And so, I mean, this was income that they had to have and that they were used to having. And then the adoption came and it was just instantly gone. They were hopeful that was a temporary period, that it would just be gone for a little bit. But there was never any intention to pay it, to never say that there were funds available.
So before you state the argument that you guys are making in seeking these funds, at what point did people start to realize that they're not getting the money? I mean, how quickly were they told?
Well, so what happened was they were given the runaround. So this started in 2009, and you know the families, you know, there are some great advocacy organizations for these children, and they were trying to rally, you know, the legislature to do something. You know, there was even a committee hearing, and these families were testifying and crying. You know, because eventually they were starting to realize, you know, in 2009, I think about 2000, two or three years after that is when they were like, I don't think anyone's coming off the waiting list. I don't think anyone's getting paid. So they started to do it through the political process and got nowhere. You know, they didn't get a single penny allocated to them. And so finally, you know, there was a little old grandma that was kind of, she was at the judge in the adoption court asked her to take the children. He wanted her because I think a daughter-in-law was going to adopt them, but he wanted someone who stayed at home. That's another point is that in order to get these children, you have to meet certain qualifications. And for some of these children, you can't work, right? Okay. And so that's how the judge didn't want these three children, you know, that were the class reps, didn't want whoever adopted them to work. You know, so I mean, look at what these families are dealing with. They can't work in order to get the children, and the state's not going to give them a subsidy.
So it's either, you know, sort of folks who are independently wealthy
yeah.
who are looking to help out these
yeah.
kids.
And those aren't the people that adopt them statistically. So
how many families? We're talking about 1,800 families, essentially, more or less?
It was 1,800 It was 1,800 children. So the families, I think the families are about, the number was around 1,400 or something like that.
And so there were 1,400 families who were, who made the decision to adopt these kids thinking that they would get support from the state. And we're not talking hundreds of millions of dollars per family. We're talking about anywhere from $15 to $25 a day. So, you know, we're talking $150, I mean, a week in the neighborhood of and to take care of a special needs child. I mean, that doesn't even seem like that much to me, frankly.
No, I mean, just, yeah.
And so they sign up with this notion that the state is going to make the funds available as it becomes available to the state. But the state is playing fast and loose with the budgets of these agencies that would support these people because they want to project that we can cut and freeze taxes and still come a surplus. This is basically the Republican fantasy world, right, where we can
Absolutely.
Get everything for less. And as long as we pick a fairly politically underrepresented and quiet segment of our population to offload essentially the cost of us projecting that we're fiscally responsible, there's not going to be any payback for this.
Yeah, excellent way to describe it. And unfortunately for the state, there was a grandma who went to, who just thought this wasn't right, went to a lawyer that had helped her in a personal injury case. This lawyer looked at this and said, this isn't right. We need, you know, the legislative process has not helped them. I know some class action lawyers down in Indianapolis. I'm going to bring this to them. We looked at it. We looked at the contract language. It said if funds were available. And we said, you know, we think it'd be tough. It'd be a tough uphill battle. But, you know, let's bring a breach of contract claim. Straightforward breach of contract saying funds were available. That condition was satisfied. So pay these families. And what was happening at the time was that this was back in 2014, the summer of 2014. Our governor, Mike Pence, was kind of being considered as a presidential hopeful. And he had made a statement in his State of the State address that he wanted Indiana to be the most adoption, because he had adopted, like private adoption. He wanted Indiana to be the most adoption-friendly state in the nation. And what he was going to do for that was to give like a $1,000 credit to families that adopt you know, wealthy people that adopt, you know, newborn babies that aren't special needs, right? And so, but
and presumably this is part of an agenda, a sort of a so-called pro-life agenda, right? And
absolutely.
But it works two ways. I also give a tax credit to wealthy families.
Yeah, it's yes, exactly. He's giving a tax credit to wealthy families that are adopting the babies that everybody wants. They're literally fighting over these babies, and then they get a $1,000 tax credit. But let's talk about all the children that nobody wants and the poor families that are adopting them and taking the burden off of the state, taking them out of foster care. And so we sued him, and you know, once this hit the, you know, kind of the wire, and there was some considerable political pressure, I believe, you know, obviously we're not up there in the governor's office, and they ended up settling the case just a few months later. So, you know, in their defense, they did make it right, you know.
So the theory that you made in terms of the breach of contract was that the money was actually in these agencies, and then the agencies were ordered to return the money back to the general fund of the state.
Yes.
And so the money was available. They just chose not to use it for that.
Yes.
And therefore, there's the breach. And then it's through this lawsuit that Mike Pence, who might be running for president, maybe he wants to be vice president. He certainly doesn't want to be seen as, now that it's hit the media, I guess,
right,
as responsible for basically cheating families who have adopted special needs kids.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just...
Yeah, and you know, and to show that, you know, claiming to the entire state in a public forum that you want to be the most adoption-friendly state in the nation, but then also our lawsuit brought to light the fact that we were the only state in the nation that didn't pay this subsidy. So I think it was just so damaging. And that you know, they obviously felt that, you know, the best thing to do was to, you know, put this lawsuit to bed as quickly as possible.
So did they settle with all of these families in terms of like restitution for?
Yeah. So we did a class action settlement because we brought the case as a class action. Only one woman had to step forward to represent everybody. And so they settled it. And what they did was they paid a set amount of money that was then just distributed to the families based on how long they had been on the waiting list and how much they were supposed to be paid. Remember that $17, $25 right. per day. But then they also agreed, they did this right like after the lawsuit was filed, but right before we went into mediation, they agreed to fund it like for two more years. So, you know, not only did the families on the waiting list get paid, now in Indiana, when you adopt a child out of special needs, out of foster care, special needs child out of foster care, you are paid this subsidy.
How many years are we into that two-year period? And
so it's 2016.
Then?
They agreed to do it through, I think most recently, I think they've agreed to do it through 2017 based on some of the budgeting numbers that we had seen. So, you know, we're watching that. You know, we're watching that and making sure that it continues to be funded. We know as a result of this lawsuit, you know, we get calls all the time, you know, so we are monitoring it. And if it ever stops, you know, we're going to, you know, look to see if there's anything we can do because this is such an important subsidy that needs to be paid.
It's pretty shocking to me just that they would put a cap on it. Like, let's just do this for 2 years. As if this need is going to sort of somehow.
Well, but again, it goes back. You know, you hit the nail on the head about the, you know, Republican fantasy world of budget surpluses and having all this extra money and cutting taxes, and you know, look who that hurts.
Right, Lynn Toops from Cohen and Malad. Thank you so much for your time today. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It. And if people want, okay, folks. All right, I think we're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program. When we do, I will tell you that Terry McAuliffe, not one of my favorite Democrats out there, governor of Virginia, restored voting rights to 200,000 people. This is 200,000 convicted felons who have obviously served their time. He did this despite the fact that his legislature is Republican run. It is an executive order. And, you know, I wonder, you know, we'll head into the fun half and we'll take some phone calls. And I'm curious. This clearly is going to have implications for the election. And it more than likely will have positive implications for the Democrats. That would be my guess anyways. If only because it was a Democrat who restored these voting rights. I'm curious. You know, for those of our callers, and I don't want to encourage anybody necessarily or discourage anybody, but for those of our callers who, and maybe we don't have them because they're not on YouTube, but is there anybody who have a problem with this? Was there anybody who has a problem with restoring the voting rights of people who have served their time? And we theoretically, right, want them to become productive, law-abiding citizens? I mean, my guess is, I don't know if someone would articulate that they would have a problem with that. I mean, who am I kidding? I'm talking about Doug, but he probably can't hear us because he's not on YouTube. So, but I will take phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The point being about that McAuliffe thing is that even the worst Dems, from my perspective, because I am not a Terry McAuliffe fan, are going to do things that have positive implications way before a Republican would. That doesn't mean that the Democratic Party is in some way not problematic in and of itself, but I'm just, you know, it's just an example of lesser of two evils, ism. And there's value there, I think. Or maybe that's forestalling the revolution in Virginia. Trump tells the Trump team has told the Republicans that Donald Trump has only been projecting an image, and he'll do a makeover. Rance Priebus slams the Never Trump movement, calls for GOP unity. I'm just looking down some headlines. Delegates face death threats from Trump supporters. Republicans worry about bringing families to their convention after pro-Trump threats. This is, wow. And this one, Joe Walsh apparently cancels a concert with Republican ties. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be a fascinating another 6 months, 7 months. Oh, God. All right, going to take a quick break. When we head back, 646-257-3920. I have the I Am Up, and so you can I Am me if you're using the app. We'll be right back. We will be back. Oh, Monday. Next week we're going to be on vacation, but it's going to be all new shows. On Monday, we're going to give you a teaser taste of Two Dope Boys as a way of encouraging you to subscribe to that program. That's Two Dope Boys. You can go to subscribe, the number 2DB. That will be on the front page. Well, you just need to go to majority.fm, and you can actually click on the Two Dope Boys to subscribe to that show. And then on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week, all new interviews. So it will be like I'm not on vacation. And for members, we have special Matt archive picks. I don't even know what they are. For all I know, he didn't even do it from our show. I hope he did. But it could be anything. All right, folks. See you in the fun half of the show. Say to Napoleon.